Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Business and Labor Committee to order today. We've got a really full agenda. A lot of people signed up to speak on a couple of the bills today. We won't get through all of them, I can tell you that right now, but we're going to get as far as we can. I'm going to start with some introductions of committee bills before we get in the public hearing. So with that, I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I was asked to let you know what the relating clause of these three bills are. LC 4029 is relating to the misclassification of employees. LC 4078 is relating to extending collective bargaining rights to certain faculty members of a public university. And LC 3033 is relating to professions that are regulated by the State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying.
Thank you. Mr. Barreto.
Chair Holvey, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 4029, dated February 21st, 2017. LC 4078, dated February 20th, 2017. And LC 3033, dated December 2nd, 2017.
Representative Barreto moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 4029, dated February 21st, 2017. LC 4078, dated February 20th, 2017. And LC 3033, dated December 2nd, 2016. Again, committee, this is for the purposes of introducing a subject matter for potential discussion in the legislature. Does not mean that you support or oppose the measure by being in favor of the introduction. So is there any discussion?
Committee bills.
Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, those LCs are introduced as committee bills, and I'll close the work session. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2189, and in the interest of time, I'm going to also open up the public hearing on House Bill 2501 and HJM3. All these subject matters are related, and when people come up, they can speak. Identify which one they're speaking about at the time, and then if you want to testify on the others or not, you know, just announce that. So, Jan, would you give us a quick summary of those three measures, please?
Mr. Chair and committee members, HB 2189 is a committee bill. It establishes that cause of action arising out of a real estate appraisal activity must be commenced before the earlier of either the applicable period of limitation or 5 years from the real estate appraisal activity. Provides exception when the claim of fraud or misrepresentation is made, and it applies to causes of action that arise on or after the effective date. House Bill 2501, chief sponsors are Representative Gomberg and Senator Johnson. It directs the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board to establish rates of pay for independent contractor appraisers and requires appraisal management companies to compensate these independent contractors at the rate set by the board. Requires appraiser management companies to pay appraiser within 31 days as opposed to 45 days or according to a scheduled agreement by the parties. Requires notice to the appraiser if the appraisal management company will not make payment. And it prohibits the appraisal management company from prohibiting the appraiser from stating the appraiser's business address on the appraisal report or from informing property owner of the appraiser's business address. Finally, it allows a person not regulated by the board to prepare real estate appraisal documents for internal use by a financial institution, a consumer finance company, or an insurance company. And the final, HJM3, the chief sponsors, Representative Gomberg and Senator Johnson and Senator Hansel. This memorial urges Congress to instruct the Appraiser Qualifications Board to revise requirements for real estate appraisers.
And again, I apologize if we don't get to your testimony. If you have written testimony that you would like to turn in, I'm actually going to instruct that our public record remain open for another 24 hours at least, so people can get home and send us written testimony if they didn't come prepared to turn it in and they don't get a chance to testify. Anyway, I just wanted to get that out. And this hearing on these three is going to end right around 2 o'clock. So with that, I'm going to call up the first three testifiers, Owen Bartels, Scott DiBiasio, and Terry Berent. And just go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and continue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Owen Bartels. I am the 2017 president of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute. The Appraisal Institute is the largest professional organization for real estate appraisers in the country. Our Greater Oregon Chapter is the largest chapter for appraisers in the state of Oregon. I am also an owner of Integra Realty Resources Portland. We're a commercial real estate appraisal firm. I have 19 employees, including appraisers, researchers, and support staff. And I'm here today to talk in support of House Bill 2189. If I might, I'd like to at least or first give a little bit of context. Real estate appraisal is impartial by its very nature, by the laws that regulate what we do and how we do it. We're oftentimes the only part of this process that is impartial. Everybody else has a specific interest, and our interest is only to the solvency of the banking system. We see ourselves as part of that, of the regulatory environment, and protectors of the public trust and consumer advocates. During the recession, there was a drain of a lot of the number of licensed appraisers from the system. The transaction volumes were not high enough to sustain a lot of those practices, and a lot of people left the field. Due to federal regulations relating to training and licensure, it's not immediate that people can re-enter. So there's a training process that's set at the federal level that's required in order to become an appraiser. We surveyed our membership here locally because we understand that there's an imbalance right now between the supply of appraisers and the need for appraisal products. We're actively looking for ways that we can increase the number of appraisers out in the field. One of the things that kept coming up to me was this unlimited liability. We're one of the only professions or the only trade group that has no cap on liability after a number of years, and where House Bill 2189 is an attempt to marry the statute of limitations against appraisal activity in the state of Oregon with an existing federal record-keeping rule that's part of our regulatory guidelines that requires that we retain files for a period of 5 years after an appraisal is delivered or 2 years after the close of litigation, whichever is longer. So that is why we're sitting here talking about 2189. Thank you very much.
And if you'd like to speak to the other bill as well.
I'd really love to let Scott. Okay.
That's fine. Defer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Business and Labor Committee, my name is Scott DiBiasio. I'm with the Appraisal Institute, and I've got a little bit of a hoarse throat here today, so I apologize if you could just bear with me. We sit here today in strong opposition to House Bill 2501. As currently drafted, Section 3 of that bill would require that the Oregon ACLB, the Appraiser Certification and Licensing Board, adopt rules establishing the payment rates for independent contractor appraisers. In establishing this fee schedule, the ACLB would be required to take into consideration academic studies, independent private sector surveys, and any other factors affecting compensation rates. There are a number of issues with House Bill 2501 which make it fatally flawed and unfit for passage. First and foremost is that Section 3 is in direct conflict with federal law, which dictates how lenders and their agents are required to determine the reason reasonable and customary fees that are paid to independent fee appraisers. Under federal law, there are two presumptions of compliance. So long as a lender or an AMC can demonstrate that they have utilized one of the presumptions of compliance, then they are presumed to comply with the requirements. Importantly, federal law preserves the market rather than any fee schedule as the primary determinant of what constitutes a reasonable and customary fee. Federal law does, however, impose the responsibility for the payment of reasonable and customary fees upon lenders and their agents, and we are supportive of the federal requirements. Under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, states are not allowed to enact laws which conflict with federal law and make it impossible for an entity to comply with both laws simultaneously. There are other issues with HB 2501. We don't believe that the ACLB has the financial and staff resources nor the expertise to be able to adequately develop the required fee schedule with any degree of accuracy and reliability. In addition, and most importantly, we do not believe that a government agency should be put in the position of establishing a fee schedule and that the market should be the primary determinant of the fees that are paid to independent fee appraisers. The provisions, this is a very interesting point. Lastly, the provisions of HB 2501 would apply only to appraisal management companies, and it fails to recognize the large number of transactions where financial institutions directly engage appraisers. Section 6 of House Bill 2501 would greatly expand the number of folks that are able to do evaluations for financial institutions where an appraisal by a state-certified appraiser is not required. We believe that current laws in place to protect Oregon citizens when entering into complex financial transactions. We don't believe that any change is currently warranted to expand the scope of providers who are permitted to provide evaluation services. While we're opposed to House Bill 2501 in its current form, we certainly would like to begin a dialogue with all stakeholders regarding giving the ACLB some authority to adjudicate complaints against AMCs in relation to alleged violations of the federal requirements. This is something that has been accomplished very effectively in many other states. And I did want to point out for the committee that when the Oregon Association of Realtors introduced House Bill 2501, a number of different stakeholders in the process reached out to them with an offer of some discussion and possible amendments. I know that I reached out to them. I know that the Trade Association for the Real Estate Valuation Advocacy Association reached out to them, and I believe that there were many others that also reached out to them. And unfortunately, we never got any phone call back or any other communication from them expressing an interest in at least talking with us about this bill. So we would like to have a conversation on reasonable and customary fees. We were hoping that perhaps that conversation could have taken place before this hearing, but I guess that wasn't to be the case. So we look forward to further discussions on this topic with this committee and with all of the relevant stakeholders. And with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. You go ahead and give us your testimony.
Chairman Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Terry Bernhardt. I live in Portland. I've been an appraiser for approximately going on 49 years now. I'm currently residential certified licensed. I've served 8 years on the state appraisal board. I've served a term on the appraiser qualifications board at the national level. I've been an officer of the National Appraisal Institute board, plus served as their audit committee chair and other chairs of committees. I teach a lot of appraisal classes. I'm here specifically to speak for 2189, the statute of limitations against real estate appraisers. I'm one of those people that have gone afoul of that law. I did an appraisal in 2007 for a lender who went insolvent, one of the major contributors to the problems we had with the mortgage industry in that time frame, Washington Mutual. And then their successor in interest was Countrywide Financial, which was another bad actor who ended up going out of business. And the third party in line, successor in line, had a policy of waiting until the very last minute, until our five-year statute mandating how long we maintain records was kept before filing a complaint. in the to comply and to demonstrate good faith, I had maintained my file and submitted it for review. And then I went through another two-year process of it being reviewed and re-reviewed, and suffered a cost in excess of $10,000 for attorney's fees and so forth, and ended up being nailed by it when, in the end, it had functionally expired. And that was a very bad experience for me personally, professionally, and everything else. It's no small consequence that as part of that, I was running for national president of the Appraisal Institute at that time, and that was cited as one of the reasons I was not selected for having an open violation on the file. And otherwise, I did real well. But close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. So anyway, I have a personal vested interest in that. As well, I'm opposed to 2501 for reasons stated. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, I'm going to defer to this panel for questions later if there's any from the committee for this panel. Not seeing any. I appreciate your testimony. I've got some legislators I'd like to get up and get into the queue.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, Representative Gomberg, and Representative Meek. And so you know, we are open under public hearing for House Bill 2189, 2501, and HJM3. So you can speak to any of those that you like.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. Very pleased to be before you today. And I wanted to talk in some general terms as I narrow down this conversation. The Oregon economy is doing well. We can always do better, but we're doing well. And that includes the real estate industry. The real estate industry is moving in a positive direction. But that being said, we've got a bottleneck. We've got a bottleneck as people try to move to closure on purchases or transactions. And the bottleneck is that we have trouble getting our appraisals taken care of in the timely fashion that we once enjoyed. I mean, the information that I've got is whereas past timelines were 1 to 2 weeks, we're now looking in many cases of a month to 45 days to get these processes complete. So I'm hearing from realtors, colleagues. I am hearing from homeowners that are trying to sell. I'm hearing from potential homeowners that want to buy. Quite candidly, I'm hearing from my own wife, who's been waiting 3 weeks for a drive-by so that we can get an appraisal done and complete our home equity loan reissue. So we've got a bottleneck out there. Now, most of this bottleneck is being created by our friends in Washington, D.C., who, with the best of intentions, created a number of new requirements on the appraiser industry. New requirements such as a college degree, 200 hours of qualifying education, 2,500 hours of practical experience over a two-year basis. And that includes an apprenticeship, whereas the average appraiser in this state is about 55 years old. And I'm sympathetic to a 55-year-old professional who says, I'm not sure I really want to take the time and effort to train my own competition. So we've got this situation. And after sitting down with professionals both in the appraiser industry and in the real estate industry, I said, what can we do about this? And two suggestions came back to me. The first was that we need to tell Congress that they need to straighten things out and make it a little bit easier for us to sell houses and properties and businesses here in Oregon. And that's the impetus for the resolution that is before you. And that would take care of much of our problem, but we still have some issues here. And that brought us to the second piece of legislation, the measure, which talks about the appraiser industry itself. And in talking to advocates, I said, we want to do a couple of things here. First of all, we want to make sure that people who do work are getting paid on a timely basis. That's in the measure. The second thing we talked about is the fact that we have a quite straightforward supply and demand environment here, that the demand is high, the supply of people to take care of that demand is low, and that results in a free market environment with higher prices, unusually higher prices. I'm being at least provided anecdotal information that that appraisals are running anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000 when previously they were in the $450 range. Now, that's anecdotal information, but it's it's the kind of information that creates a concern when at the end of the day it is homeowners, for the most part, that are paying those fees. And I don't have to tell you about the challenges that we have here in Oregon and try to provide more and more affordable housing. So we've got this issue in front of us. Let me be clear. I want professionals to be paid a fair, appropriate, and professional compensation for the work they do. And so working with advocates, I brought this piece of legislation forward to begin that conversation, to try and figure out how we can make sure that compensation is fair, reasonable, and professional for the work that's being done, but we can free up the bottleneck that is creating some very dire consequences in my district, and I imagine in many of yours. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, and I'm here to provide a little more meat on the bones of the anecdotal information. I think my colleague, Representative Meek, will speak to this as well. Representative Witt and Representative Meek and I attended a meeting in Columbia County. We were called there by about 50, and I would characterize them as grumpy real estate professionals, who were having a lot of issues with appraisals for all the same reasons that Representative Gomberg very thoughtfully and carefully and I think accurately laid out. We were hearing especially from veterans that were finding it difficult to get appraisals completed in rural areas, so that was strike two. My husband and I had just ordered an appraisal for 88 acres of greenfield ag land, and I was stunned by how long it took to make the to at least get the engagement letter, and then doubly stunned by the cost involved and the fact that the appraiser would end up owning the work product. And finally, I had a constituent who was selling a very complicated piece of property, and I admit that it was complicated. There was a gravel pit on it, a temporary RV park, and a residence. But they complained bitterly to me that the appraisal in the original email had come back at $50,000. And I called them and I said, how tragic that your property is only deemed by the appraiser to be worth this paltry amount of money, as I knew the piece of property. And they said, oh, no, Senator, you misunderstand. The fee is $50,000. And so, buoyed by the conversations that Representative Meek and Representative Witt and I heard, when Representative Gomberg put forward the possibility of joining him on a piece of legislation, I eagerly accepted the opportunity to do so. I will readily admit that I was not deeply versed in the complexities of the relationship between the real estate professionals and the appraiser professionals. And I had several very, how would I describe them, robust conversations over the last few days since this bill was scheduled for a hearing. And I expressed to the people that were calling to tear my skin off in two-inch strips that I would be an advocate for a chairman-created forum or a committee-created forum in which there might be an opportunity to work out some of these sticking points, bottlenecks, as they were characterized by Representative Gomberg. At the end of the day, I think we all want the same thing. We want people to be able to engage in real estate transactions, buoyed with accurate information prepared by professionals, get house transactions completed and property transactions completed, create more homeowners. And this is one of those things, as Representative Gomberg very accurately characterized, that our economy is picking up and it has created the dilemma that you all have before you. I would conclude by asking the professional staff to make sure that there is a letter that was submitted by an appraiser in Central Oregon by the name of Carol Rogers to make sure that that is part of the record and is distributed to the full committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holby, Vice Chair Barreto, Vice Chair Bynum, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Mark Meek. I'm representative of House District 40, which is Oregon City, Gladstone, unincorporated Clackamas County areas. And I am a real estate professional. I've been involved with as an industry leader at the state, national, and local level as a realtor and part of the Realtors Association for many years. And in that capacity, last year, I was communicating with realtors all over the state, from Malheur County to Wallowa County, Klamath County, Clatsop County, Columbia County, and beyond the communication with those realtors and my own anecdotal experiences with my clients, I'm glad this conversation is being started. And I think that's the most important part of this. We do have a crisis here that there are homeowners that are losing their homes because, or they're losing the opportunity to buy the house that they made an offer on and got accepted. what's happening, the competition is so stiff right now that I have to put in, my clients put in a 45-day close. If we don't get that appraisal back in time to meet that closing point, there are multiple offers on some of these homes, and the sellers are deciding, well, you didn't do it in time, I'm going on to the next guy that had a $20,000 higher offer price than you. So it's actually being uncompetitive for buyers that are getting their offers accepted. And is it the appraisal industry's fault? No. They have a lack of qualified appraisers, and that is a national, a federal part of their federal guidelines to get qualified. So similar to the information they said, the four-year degree, the 2 years of apprenticeship, it is putting a burden on folks wanting to enter the appraisal industry for a six-year process out of your life to do that type of work. It's very difficult. And I totally respect the appraisers, what they go through, and the fees that they get. What we've been seeing is, though, that some of these appraisals are going on a bidding process now, and if you want your appraisal done sooner, then some of these mortgage companies, banks are offering more money, and it's being accepted. And that goes straight not to cost or not to any other additional work that you have to do for a certain appraisal. It's just based on first come, first serve, come on and get me out of here, get my client served first. That's not a very good equitable system for folks that are trying to just afford a home and can't afford to pay an additional $2,000 just for an appraisal. So, in summary, I support, I'm very happy to see that the conversation is being started. I think it is an issue that we need to address, and it is very, it's affecting both folks getting into homes, the process of getting in home, and also the process of getting the transactions completed. So I thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward to testify in front of the committee, and it does look like a good topic to have a discussion on, no doubt about it. So I'm going to defer to get you out of here, because I know you're in other committees with potential important things to vote on, perhaps.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are in the quorum of the committee next door.
Yeah, we're all together. Yes, so thank you,
thank you
for your testimony. Up next, I'll have Marlo Dill, Charles Rex, and Carl Stillman. And again, if you would just introduce yourself for the record before you speak, and if you're going to identify which bill you're speaking to us about it at any given point. Thank you.
Okay, I'll try to be brief, as I do concur with the first three speakers.
Yeah, no sense in doing too much repetition.
Right.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Marlo Dill, I am an agricultural real estate appraiser, specialize in large acreage farm and ranch appraisal. I'm currently District 7 VP for the American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. House Bill 2189, as I concur, appraisals are typically reviewed and either accepted as is or modified within a short duration of that original production of the appraisal. If a material defect is found in the appraisal, it's dealt with. They're going to do that before the appraiser gets paid, hence the 30 days to pay the appraiser. It's unreasonable to believe that a material defect in an appraisal can warrant productive discussion beyond this five-year time frame, based on the record-keeping rule at a federal level. So with that in consideration, I would prefer that you vote yes on House Bill 2189.
My name is Charles Rex IV. I'm an MAI and the owner of CRI Valuation LLC, based out of Sisters, Oregon. I do work all over the country.
Can you just say what MAI is? Acronyms sometimes aren't helpful.
It is a professional designation with the Appraisal Institute. It used to stand for member of the Appraisal Institute, and no longer does. But the designation is MAI. It's one of the highest levels of designation that you can have in the industry itself.
Okay.
And from that point, I'm a fourth-generation MAI. Everybody in my family, going back to my great-grandfather, at the inception of this industry, was certificate number 42, if that gives you any background. So appraisal has been in my blood. It's been the dinner conversation for years. Anyway, I am testifying regarding strong objection to House Bill 2501. Section 3 specifically kind of makes my blood boil. And Section 3 states that the Appraisal Certification and Licensure Board shall adopt rules establishing the payment rates for independent contract appraisers. I fervently object to any rate establishment by a government entity on a private business. The market is capable of supplying the rates that are acceptable to the user. And the rates, in order to assume that a board could establish a rate schedule for any type of appraisal work, is it's insurmountable. The reason why is the complexities of the appraisal assignment is varied. Not all appraisers just do single-family residential work. I do railroad corridors, 1,800-mile railroad corridors. Fees on those are in the millions of dollars. We're not talking thousands. But that also takes 10 to 15 years to complete. So thinking that a board would be capable of even coming up with a fee schedule is ridiculous, not to mention the education that goes behind it. And when you do a fee schedule, what is that going to do to the market participants, both your homeowners, your banks, your loan officers, the AMCs? Well, you're going to see a shortage of supply of appraisers. They're not going to be there anymore because they'll do work in other states. There'll be no incentive to become more educated and get cutting-edge technology and take the risk that it would take to actually make your product better. At this rate, the final piece that I want to talk about is how the quality of a work product varies among appraisers. You have some work product that just barely meets the minimum requirements of credibility and reliability. Well, establishing a rate schedule will do is ensure that you're only going to get the minimums. If you allow the market to control it, work products are going to continue to become better as a competitive position from an appraisal perspective. And so I strongly urge that this committee not vote no on this House Bill 2501. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead. My name is Carl Stillman. I'm a private fee appraiser here in Salem. I actually live in Representative Evans' district, but he doesn't happen to be here today. I'll be very brief. I'm in favor of 2189 for the reasons stated, and oppose 2501 also for the reasons stated. My appraisal practice is primarily in complex agricultural, large acreage properties. And for the same reasons that Mr. Rex stated, it's unfathomable to me that the ACLB would be in any way competent to set my fees. I work in a competitive environment where if a client typically calls, I give them a fee quote and a time frame. I know I'm competing against several other people. Typically, the best situation for the client wins. And either I get the work or don't, based on how long I promise it's going to take and the fee that I've asked to be compensated for. And I can tell you that I don't get all the jobs I bid for, because there are other people out there doing them, and so that is a competitive environment. It's not like there's only one residential appraiser doing work, or one farm appraiser doing work, or one commercial appraiser doing work. There's lots of us out there, and we accept work based on a fee turn time basis. So, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and we're going to move on with some more people to testify. Up next, Sean Cleave, Adam Schwind, and Randy Shaw.
Good afternoon,
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I am the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Association of Realtors. Thank you for bringing forward the three bills for the record. Currently, Oregon Association of Realtors is neutral on House Bill 2189, and we are in support of House Bill 2501 and House Joint Memorial 3. A couple things I want to do just really briefly. We do have six realtors here that do have specific stories that they want to illustrate for the committee, so I don't want to belabor the issue. In around 2015, I started getting contacted by members of the association, also members of the assembly, who had constituents that were dealing with either what they felt were coercive tactics in high-priced appraisers, or not able to get an appraisal at all on a residence they were purchasing. I drew the short straw, being the government affairs director, to do the research, and what I found out was at the federal level, we have some barriers to entry. Although adopted, I think with the intent of protecting the consumer, they have led to a disincentive for people to become appraisers. We also have an issue where appraisers probably aren't compensated on average a high enough level to incentivize more people to come in. Regarding 2501 and the normal and customary rate language in Section 3 of the bill, that language is from Dodd-Frank. It is provided in that act to states to set what those rates are. The language is consistent with that federal guidelines. I want to be very, very explicit here. It is not our intent to suggest that language as a way to cap rates. On the contrary, I would look at that as more of a basement conversation than a cap. Now, also, given the way the language is currently drafted, I think there is plenty of room for negotiation. But from a consumer perspective and a consumer protection perspective, I think it's probably good to have the conversation which you've provided the opportunity for today, which I thank you. Also, just to correct the record, I was contacted twice by people in the appraisal industry, once by Lori Egan, who I believe is here in the audience today. Her name, she is an appraiser to whom I have met multiple times, and the executive director of the Real Estate Valuation Advocacy Association, REVA, Mr. Mark Schiffman. Both of those people I engaged in email and verbal over the phone conversations. I had not been contacted by any of the other representatives of the association. I just wanted to correct that for the record. I want to frame up something for you really quick, and then I'll turn it over to our members here to testify. In 2016, the Appraisal Institute said that 62% of appraisers were 51 years or older, 24% are between 36 and 50, and only 13% currently are 35 years or younger. If we have a problem on a bottleneck right now, if something isn't done to address this, both on the education side and compensation side, I think the problem's going to get a lot worse, and you'll get a flavor for what those types of things look like. And with that, I'm going to close my testimony and answer any questions if you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Adam Schwend. I'm the president of the Tillamook County Board of Realtors and a Tillamook City Councilor. I'm here today to tell you the story about Jason and Shanna, a couple in their 20s who live in Tillamook with their son Jackson. Jason is a welder. Shanna is a stay-at-home mom. In late 2015, they reached out to me about finding a home for their family. They had found the perfect place. It needed a little bit of work, but it was on an acre of land, and it would allow them some space to have a garden and allow Jackson to play. Right after Christmas, we found out that Jason and Shanna's offer had been accepted, so we ordered the inspection, opened escrow, and Jason and Shanna began to imagine themselves in their dream home. Immediately upon hearing that we had an accepted offer, Jason and Shanna's loan originator ordered the appraisal. Since it was an FHA loan, we asked for 60 days to close, and FHA appraisals are more in-depth, require more work, and fewer appraisers will take them on. After all the other steps were complete, we waited for the appraisal to come back. And we waited. And we waited. After 35 days had passed, the lender contacted me and said that five appraisers had turned the work down. And in Tillamook County, five appraisers is the entire stock of appraisers, plus some. The lender had even offered a bonus above the standard $750 FHA fee appraisal. The lender asked me to track down some possible appraisers, reach out to anyone I thought could help. Finally, after 45 days of searching, we were able to get an appraiser from the Portland metro area who happened to be on vacation. They took the job. And if I might digress for just a moment, last year, around the same time, a client of mine paid $2,000 for a rush appraisal and was able to get that appraisal finished, completed, and delivered in 14 days. But that wasn't possible for Jason and Shanna. They didn't have the extra money. The appraisal was received finally after received 5 days before we were scheduled to close. The appraisal had some conditions that needed to be addressed, so we requested a 5-day extension to finish the final disclosures and address concerns. But the seller refused. In the course of escrow, a full-price cash backup offer had come in. It was cash, so no appraisal would be needed. So there was no way to complete the required tasks in time. In order to protect Jason and Shanna's earnest money, we terminated the deal, and they were devastated. Jason and Shanna did everything right. They saved money for a down payment. They bought a home that needed fixing to keep their payments low and build more equity quickly. They maintained good credit and provided every document requested of them promptly. Yet because they weren't able to come up with an extra $2,000 for an appraisal, let alone $170,000 in cash, they lost out on their dream home. Today I ask you to consider the two bills in front of you to help people like Jason and Shanna, and to help address this crisis, which disproportionately affects young, rural, and low-income Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name's Randy Shaw, and I'm the owner and principal broker of Coldwell Banker Home and Premier Realty in Klamath Falls, Oregon. And, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you and the distinguished members of your committee for allowing me to testify today. I'm here to tell a story. Michael and Cecilia Britton have asked me to come here and tell this story. Now, this is a true story, and it started in April of 2016. They had a home, a split-level home in Klamath Falls that they decided they needed to downsize a bit, excuse me, and to transfer their baby boomer legs onto a single-level home. They contacted an agent in my office and decided that they would put the home on the market and also asked this agent to find them another home to replace the one that they decided to sell. We put the home on the market and immediately had quite a little bit of activity on the home. When this happened, they then went out and started to look for another home right away because they didn't want to get caught not having a home if they sold the one they were living in. We took in an offer, negotiated a contract about the middle of April. They then were out looking right at that time, and they found a home, luckily, right around the same time that they went under contract with the one they were selling. At that point, they negotiated on that home, and within 2 weeks after accepting an offer on their home, they were under a contract in a home to purchase. We waited for about 2 to 3 weeks and got notice that we were going to get an appraisal on their home around the 1st of June. That puts them right around 75 days out from the time that they went under contract. At this point, they said, that's great. We have some extra time to pack. That'll be a good thing for us. So they went about their business. Eventually, they weren't getting contacted by their lender who was going to loan on the house they were purchasing. At that point, in about the middle of May, concern began to grow on their side of the table because they hadn't been contacted by anyone to do this appraisal. We had advised them early on that this appraisal would probably take 6 to 8 weeks. You see, Klamath Falls has been under this for a couple of years now. Appraisals taking 90 to 120 days to get a site review. At that point, they started to become concerned. They came into my office and their agent stuck his head into my office and said he'd like to have me meet with them in the conference room. When I walked in that room, it was obvious that there was a lot of stress in these two people. At that point, I said, well, let's call the lender and find out what's going on. We called the lender, and they said that day they had received three bids from three appraisers. The first appraiser could come right around the middle of July. We had advised them that we could try to close both of these about the middle of July. 65, 70 days out seemed logical. So what they said was, well, the first person would come right around the middle of July, but that was going to be $1,000. And they really couldn't pin that $1,000 down. It might be a little more than that. The second appraiser was going to come first part of August, which put them a couple of weeks past the sale of their home, for $750. And then the third appraiser, he could come in the middle of August for $500. At that point, Cecilia lost it. Stood up, tears in her eyes, went out the door and said, "That's extortion." And then proceeded to go out into the hall. We got her back in the room, calmed her down, and eventually what took place was they closed their home on July 13th of that year, and then they had to pay the person that owned the home that they were trying to purchase an additional $950 so that they could occupy early. We closed that home on August 9th. The second home took 108 days to close. The first home took 97. These people went through a very stressful time in their life just to get this job done. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate just one question. In all these cases, did anyone file a complaint with the Appraisal Licensure Board about this, about these issues?
There really, we didn't see any grounds necessarily to file the complaint.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there wasn't really much to go on in terms of a complaint.
Okay. All right. It just seems like the issue might have come up with them. I don't know. Anyway, I appreciate that. We're running real short on time, so I'm going to move on to Brian Glanville and Keith Traherne. And Bob Fitz. So if you could keep your comments really short and try not to repeat stuff we've already heard, that'd be helpful.
Sure.
Thank you.
Chairman Hovey and members of the Business and Labor Committee, I'm Brian Glanville, and I speak in opposition to House Bill 2501. I'm a native Oregonian. I've been a real estate appraiser in the state of Oregon for over 40 years. I've served as the Oregon chapter president of the Appraisal Institute and later as their national president. I also served as chair for North and South America for RICS, an international organization similar to the National Association of Realtors, NAR, and I held the Counselor of Real Estate Designation from NAR. I also represented the United States on the International Valuation Standards Council. Appraisal for lending purposes is essentially an audit function to keep lenders from making bad loans that hurt the consumer. In the late 1980s, Congress allowed savings and loans to make commercial loans, and that brought along a major recession because the savings and loans didn't have any experience or any training. Oregon was one of the only two states who licensed appraisers. Congress then mandated that in FIREA that appraisers be licensed in every state. I was chapter president and participated in writing ORS 674 at the time in order to bring Oregon into compliance so that lending would not be shut down in this state. The lenders wanted to fast-track the bill and put in many exceptions shown in your House Bill 2051 in order to placate many stakeholders. They did not allow a exception for brokers and realtors to do appraisal work for lending. In 2006, lenders found a way around the system through mortgage-backed securities and bundling of loans without appraisals, which helped result in the Great Recession we've just experienced over the last 10 years. Real estate has cycles, business and real estate both have cycles, and ever since 1775, we've had a real estate recession every 5 to 10 years. We're now in our 8th year coming out of a recession. We're probably going to be going into another one sometime in the near future. It's a cycle. It's supply and demand. Right now, Oregon remains a hot market. I'm part of a national company, and the rest of this country is not in a hot market. There's only a few cities that are. My partner bought a house recently in Portland, and they were able to get an appraisal in Portland within 5 days. My daughter bought one 2 months ago, and she had her appraisal within 10 days. Depends on location. I'll give you Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, some other places. There's not as many appraisers. Again, it's a supply and demand. Brokers and realtors are trained real estate professionals, but they're not trained to have experience in estimating market value. A dentist and a heart surgeon are both medical professionals, yet I would not advocate allowing either one to do the other's business. They are not trained in that area. Section 6 of this bill does exactly that. And just real briefly, just to cover a couple things, 2189 I support as far as the statute of limitations. 2501 needs rewriting very badly, and we would be willing to work with the brokers on that. As far as writing Congress, that's already underway. The appraisal qualifications board of the Appraisal Foundation is already working on possibly changes for the licensed appraisers that do residential, because they're recognizing there is a problem. But when someone asks me for an expedited appraisal, I explain to them, you're asking me to tell my appraiser he has to work nights or weekends. It's going to cost you more if you want it. If not, you'll have to wait till we get through the system. As far as what Senator Johnson explained on that bid for $50,000, she needs to get more than one bid. There are other people that do it for less than that. Someone else bid rather high.
Thank you. I'd really like to get a little more testimony. I don't mean to be rude and cut you off, but I am running out of time. At least the two gentlemen here could tell us where they are on the bills.
I could speak about all of them, but I'm going to just directly go to 2501. My name is Keith Trahern. I've been a real estate appraiser for 27 years. My dad was a county assessor, state rep, and was an appraiser who taught me. Want to talk about some of the things that we have that some of these people aren't talking about. We're dealing with AMCs. We're dealing with realtors. AMCs at sometimes will come to us and say, we want you to do the appraisal, but we want only pay you half your fee, and we're going to keep the other half. The appraiser is the one taking the liability on that. So that is an issue that's not being addressed here today. The other thing is, the real estate agents. You have in your testimony that's already pre-written in of an agent down in Southern Oregon in Williams area that complained that they had to pay $1,700 for an appraisal. What they didn't tell you is that agent got paid between 3% and 6% of the which was between $15,000 and $30,000. So the appraiser got $1,700. We don't know how much the AMC got of that $1,700. So we have multiple problems with that issue. The other thing that the realtor didn't explain was that was three separate tax lots and 25 acres in a vineyard area. And as you know, Measure 91, Southern Oregon, irrigation rights is just growing with marijuana. We're having to deal with that. We're having to go out from Southern Oregon. We have to go out and inspect properties and comparables where we know there's people with loaded guns looking at us, and we have to be careful what we're doing. Now, I know people in the Portland area don't have to deal with that as much. So when I go work from here, Lakeview, anywhere in Southern Oregon, I have to deal with that. My appraisals, in 1989, I charged $450. Today, I charge $600. We have not had a fee increase until this last 2 years. We've been stuck on the same rates. A lot of people got out of the business. So we need to look at these issues. It's more complex than just one thing. It affects everybody. And if all these people get out of the business, you think it's a long wait now? Wait until there's no appraisers. So
thank you.
My name's Bob Fitz. I'm a certified residential appraiser in Happy Valley, Oregon. I do both rural and work in the city of Portland. I'm also FHA. I wanted to testify today because I've never done this before, so this is something that I had to really think about before I put it out here, so I'm a bit nervous. But the fact that something I heard about collusion or that it's extortion, it would take collusion on appraisers' parts to get together and really fix prices. And that isn't what's happening in the industry. What I find with AMCs, and I deal with a lot of them, is they'll send me an email and say, will you do this in 10 days, do this report in 10 days, and we'll pay you $2,000. And I've got a backlog of reports, but I'm willing to lose sleep over $2,000 to take that appraisal report because they really need it. I didn't set the price. I didn't set the rates. That's coming from the lender. So I just wanted to say that. I'll keep it short. I'm just saying that we're not out there in a group trying to fix prices. We're out there doing what the market will bear. And the market right now is very busy.
Thank you. I do appreciate your perspectives and you coming today to testify and letting us know where you're at on that. And I'm sure we're going to be having some more conversations. Thank you very much. I have one more person who's traveled from Jackson County, Patrick Eiler.
Eiler.
And if you could concentrate and not repeating things, keeping it short, that'd be great.
Yeah, I have a couple of stories that would be repetitive, so I'm going to avoid doing that. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. When I knew I was going to come up here and testify to you, I had asked realtors in my area to let me know some of the stories that they had.
And if you could give us your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, Patrick Eiler, and I'm with Patrick Eiler Real Estate.
Go ahead.
In Southern Oregon. Okay. To continue on, these stories basically had kind of the same theme that you've been hearing already of where appraisals have been taking too long and the cost has just been exorbitant. And when you talk about supply and demand, we understand that as realtors. We certainly do. But we have to take in consideration the actual effect to the consumer. And you've been hearing some of the stories of what's happening. And when a consumer gets to the point where they've been waiting, they've been spending money to buy a house, they're excited, especially the first-time home buyers are looking at getting their first home. I'm sure you can probably go back and remember when you bought your first home, how scary it was and yet exciting at the same time. Well, all of these things are being hurt by the fact that these appraisals are taking so long and that these first-time home buyers and other buyers are having to spend so much money to get the appraisers. And we're just looking for a way to address that, and that's what this bill does. And I'll just leave that at that. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate the conversation and the balance from both sides, and I know we need to be respectful, but this is a tough issue for many. So thank you very much for your testimony today. I know several others have signed up on these three bills. Again, we'll keep the public hearing open until, let's do the close of day tomorrow, 5 o'clock, give folks a chance to get any additional written testimony they want in, and appreciate we have gotten a substantial amount of testimony in writing as well, and the committee, most of that is on OLIS. If you want to get a little more in depth on the testimony there. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2501, House Bill 2189, and HJM3. And we'll give just a couple of minutes. If you're leaving, and make sure you take your talking outside. I appreciate it.
Can I dial in this guy from Seattle now?
Yes.
No, he's just calling. You know, Trump has opinions about appraisals.
Dylan, hi, this is Jan Nordland. We're just about ready to start the public hearing.
I'm just calling the realtor. I'm working in the Seattle area and asked her how long it's taking.
If you could take your conversations outside, thank you. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2856.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a committee bill, and it creates a grant program at Boley to provide funding for outreach, education, and technical assistance to Oregon workers regarding their rights in the workplace. It appropriates general fund money to fund the grant program, and it provides additional remedy of compensatory and punitive damages and civil actions for alleged discrimination or retaliation against the employee for filing a claim involving wages, sick leave, family medical leave, and protected leave for victims of domestic violence. It allows the award of compensatory damages against the employer who takes an adverse action against the employee for inquiring about or discussing their wage or the wage of another employee. And there is a -1 amendment that's on OLIS, and it provides compensatory and punitive damages and civil actions for alleged discrimination or retaliation against those employees for discussing or disclosing wage information.
All right, I'll call up first Kate Newall, John Hoffman, and Dwayne Boyce. Oh, is it Darren Boyce?
Excuse me.
Printing is sometimes even hard to read. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
All right. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall with Family Forward Oregon. And House Bill 2856 is a bill that we, along with others, have been working on. And essentially, this bill addresses two issues. So I'll talk about each of those quickly because I know we're short on time. But the first one is to create a worker education grant fund. Unfortunately, workers are often unaware of their employment rights and are not able to understand the various workplace protections under Oregon state law and federal law. Low-income workers who are most in need of these protections are also often the least likely able to access information about state and federal civil rights protections, leave laws, required meal and rest periods, overtime protections, appropriate worker classifications, and by that I mean is someone an independent contractor and appropriately classified that way, an employee, are they appropriately classified as a salary employee, or are they an hourly employee due overtime, and basic workplace health and safety standards. These laws can be confusing for a worker to navigate, especially when facing what is sometimes an urgent issue at work. I know that workers need better education about their employment rights. And while the state does provide free resources for employers to help them understand and follow the law when situations arise, there's no such equivalent resource for employees that can help answer their questions and understand their rights. So, for example, Boley has the Technical Assistance for Employers division that helps field questions and produces FAQs and fact sheets for employers. There's nothing similar, a resource at Boley for workers. This put workers at a disadvantage and means that the most vulnerable workers are the ones most likely to be impacted by both common mistakes and much more serious workplace abuses. Employers and employees alike want our laws to be followed, and I think educating all members of the workforce equally will help break down those barriers of understanding about employment law and ensure greater compliance across the board. So Sections 1 and 2 create a grant program that is actually modeled after a very similar grant program at the Office of Labor Standards in Seattle, and I think you're going to hear more about that in a minute. We believe that community-based organizations are crucial partners for enforcement agencies. Their ties to workers in specific industries and in specific sectors, as well as their roots in certain marginalized communities, make them the best able to reach and to educate these workers. Section 3 deals with a slightly different issue, which is enforcement provisions for certain civil rights violations. All civil rights violations with a private right of action are enforceable under ORS 659A 885, but not all of the remedies under this section are equal. Certain violations are enforceable under subsection 1, while others are enforceable under subsection 3. Both 1 and 3 allow a mistreated worker to get rehired, back pay for up to 2 years, prevailing party costs, and attorney's fees. But only subsection 3 allows an aggrieved worker to also get compensatory damages, punitive damages, and allows for a trial by jury. I did put in OLIS a chart that sort of explains the difference between subsection 1 and subsection 3, and then identifies what each of the statutes that we've named in the bill and in the Dash 1 amendments are, to save folks the time of looking up each and every one of those statutes. But I guess the point in this one is that, to me, the nature of the remedy doesn't necessarily tie up or align with what, in my mind, are some of the more egregious violations. So I definitely think that we should true some of those up and make sure that some of the worst offenses do have the most appropriate remedy provisions. With that, thank you.
Thank you. And so we will go to Dylan now in Seattle. Dylan Orr, are you still there?
Good afternoon. Yes, I am, sir.
If you could just state your name and then give us your testimony and experience from Seattle, please. Thank you.
Sure thing. I am Dylan Orr, the Director of the Office of Labor Standards for the City of Seattle, and thank you for the opportunity to provide telephonic testimony to you today. Some brief history about who we are and where we've come. Seattle's first labor standard, paid sick and safe time, went into effect in 2012, followed by our Fair Chance Employment Ordinance, which went into effect in 2013. In April of 2015, Seattle's minimum wage and wage theft ordinances went into effect, At that same time, Seattle's Office of Labor Standards was established as a division within our Office for Civil Rights. Since that time, we've increased remedies and protections for workers and added two new laws to the books. And in January of 2017, the Office of Labor Standards became an independent department. As far as our outreach and community-based outreach, we've put out our first RFP, request for proposals, for the Community Outreach and Education Fund in July of 2015 for a total amount of $1 million. We selected 10 different organizations and community partnerships to receive funding through this this grant, which included a total of 23 organizations that were involved in this work. The RFP was focused on reaching groups with experience and relationships with low-wage working communities who experience the highest rates of workplace violations, including female workers, workers of color, immigrant and refugee workers, workers with disabilities, LGBTQ workers, and youth workers. Organization activities we are seeking focus on outreach and education and included door-to-door outreach, hosting and participating in community-based education events, developing training materials and conducting training to educate workers and other organizations about Seattle's labor standards, and providing labor rights intake, counseling, and referrals for workers experiencing labor standards violations. The contract process was developed through a racial equity toolkit that resulted in guiding principles to support organizations and groups that are representative of communities most likely to be impacted by labor standards violations and that are connected to a similar network of organizations. Also, to leverage opportunities likely to have the greatest impact on eliminating racial and social inequities in the community and encourage collaborative and creative approaches. To engage communities through language-specific and culturally appropriate outreach and education and provide open and transparent communication about progress and learning that resulted from the funding process. In line with those principles, we provided a workshop for participants after releasing the RFP at a community-accessible location to provide a level playing field of understanding about our labor standards and what we're looking for, and provide an opportunity for organizations to partner with one another in their applications. We also provided for an option to submit both a written or an oral presentation or do both, and had an internal review committee to evaluate proposals based on several criteria laid out to ensure we are reaching the communities most impacted by labor standards violations. The contracts from year one just ended in December, and we are finalizing our look-back report. There are some metrics that I can share with you now. So collectively, the Community Outreach and Education Fund recipients reached over 1 million people through radio interviews, news articles, mass emails, and social media posts about their labor standards rights. Conducted a combined 1,033 outreach events and trainings that reached 83,005 workers. And 470 of those outreach and events and trainings, or 45% of them, were conducted in languages other than English, which is a key point. They also conducted intakes with 481 workers who sought advice on labor standards rights and possible violations. Those community organizations referred 62 of these cases to our office and were able to refer 231 of these complaints to other organizations, including themselves, for resolution. In year two, we just put out our latest RFP in November for our next round of recipients, and we followed a similar process to the first round that I laid out and just announced those recipients in January. For a second round of grants or contracts, we have $3.3 million, $1.8 million in 2017 and $1.5 million in 2018. We've determined to make these two-year contracts, which we're very excited about. That work will begin in February and go through the end of February of 2019, and we are building off of year one, including lessons learned by us and the organizations involved, deepening the work and building off the focus from year one, which was on mostly education and outreach. Happy to answer any other questions you have, but I know that the time is brief, so I'll leave it there.
Thank you. I was just curious where you got your $1 million to start this outreach program.
City Council approved that funding after it was determined that outreach and education was the way to, with community organizations that the community trust, is the way to have the most impact on labor standards rights.
I guess I was more curious where the city of Seattle got it. I mean, what was it, part of a sales tax? Was it, you know, a fee on labor or a fee on employers or what?
that initial round came through the general fund, but the funding conversation is a whole separate conversation, but yes.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to probably move on here shortly, but Kate, it would be interesting to see when you're talking about your penalty structure and comparing that to the penalty structure that the city of Seattle has on these similar violations. That might be helpful for us too.
Okay.
If you can communicate with Mr. Dylan Orr there and figure that out.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. I think that would be a good idea, and I will communicate with Dylan to get to that
Thank
information.
You. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Hi, my name is John Hoffman. I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf and in favor of HB 2856. I have condensed my written testimony, which is available to you electronically. Last December, I worked for a promotional company which violated several labor laws. They had a policy in which the workers would forfeit their entire pay for the 9-day program if they missed work for any reason, including illness or family emergency. They also misclassified its workers as independent contractors. They required workers to arrive 15 minutes prior to the shift without compensation, and they had a policy delaying pay of up to 60 days after the completion of the event. These are blatant violations, and yet, as a worker, I have a tremendous task in finding resources to ensure the enforcement of my rights. In my case, the company has neither the incentive nor the fear of punishment to adhere to the law. Due to Boley's caseload and their limited resources, the company can render payment whenever it is convenient for them. Even if I chose to file a claim through Boley, once the company paid the wages, the Boley would not pursue the penalty wages. So why should a company follow the law? Unfortunately, workers cannot rely on the companies to police themselves. Penalties seem to be the only appropriate path to toward compliance. If a worker decides to enter the intimidating option of a small claims court action, they're on their own. And even then, if the employer requests a jury trial, the lawyer needs to get an attorney, which is a difficult task and can add up to considerable upfront costs. Eventually, I did receive my wages. And even though I showed up for the required 15-minute pre-shift time, the company did not pay me for the time of each day that I worked. Having to confront the company about the pay discrepancy, I did not receive my full wages until 30 days past due. In preparations for the a small claims court filing, I sent the company owners an email requesting the penalty wages for the 30-day waiting period. In response, the company president replied, and I'm quoting, "We have encountered this before, and we are prepared if you continue your pursuit of extortion. You have been paid in full for your time as an independent contractor, and you were never an employee of GTE agency." After following multiple agency referrals in a circular pattern, after consulting with an attorney, and after being called an extortionist, how do I hold this company accountable? Clearly, they have violated the law. Is standing up for my rights worth the continued investment of time, energy, and uncertain financial resources? I wish I could say this is a rare experience, but since finishing this job, I sought similar employment through three other companies. All three companies were based out of state, all three companies hired as independent contractors, and all three companies pay on the net 30 policy. This is a rampant problem. And yet, relatively, I have an easier go of it. I'm a single middle-aged man, and I have been in the workforce for over 30 years. I have educated myself to my rights as a worker, and I have a strong command of the English language, but I'm still going in circles trying to uphold my rights. I asked the committee to consider the other workers that were on this promotional team, most of them in their early 20s. Do they know the parameters between a employee and an independent contractor? I wonder if they realize that when a company requires you to be on site for a certain amount of time that they need to pay you for the entirety of that shift. I wonder if they even got paid for the entirety of their wages for this program. I wonder if they realize if they get hurt that they are not protected. So I ask the committee to consider all Oregonians. What about the workers that do not speak English, or do not have English as their primary language? Do they have the resources to assist them? What about the workers that are working two and three jobs trying to make ends meet to support their families? Do they have the time to research and pursue violations without state and community support? The passage of House Bill 2856 provides an opportunity to bridge this gap, and I urge you to approve this bill and support Oregonian workers. In this moment, the workers of Oregon are counting on you. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Darren Boyce, and I'm here to testify about the devastating impacts of being cheated out of hard-earned wages and how difficult it is to try and figure out what to do about it. So a few years ago, I took a new job as a sheet metal company. I'm a construction worker. I found myself working as many as 14 days for 2 weeks straight. When payday came, my employer was holding on to my check and also a fake time card that he had filled out with missing hours. He shorted me like it was $650 to be exact. And he, you know, after, you know, him trying to get me to accept that money, in this situation, I was able to get that money back. But there was several other employees at that company, spoke Spanish primarily, that I know for a fact they've told me that they had the same issues dealing with that particular employer. And throughout my career, I've been forced to fill out time cards in pencil, had to be in pencil. And it was had to be done off the clock. And then when you work several different jobs and you have to fill out a time card breaking down the material you use, it can, you're looking at like 30, sometimes 40 minutes of filling out a time card off the clock. What I did was, you know, me specifically, I spoke up, you know, but my employer wouldn't budge. He told me, you know, to take what I was given and that I was lucky to have the job that I had. Without the family support, I was left to, I had a family to support. I was left to struggle. I couldn't budget for expenses because my hourly wage kept changing. He kept changing my hours as well on the same job. I had to borrow money from my family and my friends and even had to draw out of my retirement account just to provide for my family. Nobody should have to experience this kind of frustration. Nobody should have to dip into their retirement just to put food on the table. And along the way, you know, I didn't have anybody. I didn't know who to talk to or who to go to for help. I knew what was happening was wrong. You know, but eventually, without a union organizer walking onto the job site I was working on, I never would have been able to recover any of the stolen wages that I had lost. I couldn't afford to take any time off due to my owed wages to go see someone at Boley or talk to a lawyer to get my stolen wages back. I, along with everyone else I worked with, were scared to speak up for the fear of losing their job, my job and theirs, or reduction of hours. I had a family to support, and earning some money was a whole lot better than no money coming in. We need to do a better job of educating the workforce out there on what their rights are and who to contact if their rights are being violated. I'm very thankful that I had somebody to guide me to the appropriate authorities to report these thefts of my hard-earned wages and to help me stop this from happening to anyone else at these companies. Members of the House Committee on Business and Labor, I'm here to ask you to take this problem seriously and to make the changes that our state needs so that nobody has to go through what I've been through. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. And we've had some other bills around this same subject. Got a lot of people to testify, and I'm not seeing any critical issues for questions right now. So thank you so much for sharing your stories and testifying with us today. I'm going to bring up Jenny Dressler, Amanda Dalton, and Elizabeth Rimley.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton. I'm here today on behalf of the Columbia Gorge fruit growers. You know, you hear a lot from the employer community asking you to look at bills in their totality, both what's before you today, but also what you've passed in the past or passed in previous sessions. We were before you just a couple weeks ago talking about a series of bills that would affect the prevailing party or prevailing plaintiff wage theft claims. You also heard from us in 2016 on some pretty significant wage theft legislation. We ask that you look at this bill no differently and take it as it's in its entirety. As most of you know, Senate Bill 1587 was adopted in 2016. This bill was the product of months of work groups, both from the employer community, the employee advocates, Senator Dembro, and maybe yourself, Chair. Weeks and weeks of work to make sure that we got this bill right. You've heard from us before, we take this issue of wage theft very seriously. We also believe it's a small portion of the overall employer community. 1587 made some pretty significant changes, and I remind you of this just because this bill is only about a year old, so we have yet to really see what all it's done. In addition to requiring some pretty substantial expansion of the itemized payroll list, 1587 provided for new wage enforcement specialists funded through the employer-paid wage security fund. Wage enforcement specialists are to pursue cases of non-payment and underpayment of wages under both Chapter 652 and 653, which are most of your wage and hour claims. Our concern with this bill is it seems to create a new grant program with taxpayer dollars to fund nonprofits and private entities to go door-to-door, or we would argue farm-to-farm, armed with new and expanded education and remedies. It's really far beyond just an education bill. Rather than implement the new program, we're here today urging you really to take a closer look at the existing law that's on the books for wage and hour. We continue to come back every session and recognize that this is a problem. If we're not doing what we should be doing, or if BOLI doesn't have the tools that they need to really satisfy this issue, then we ask for you to continue to look at the funding. Like I said, we just put new money into the wage and enforcement BOLI division last year. If it's not enough, then let's go down to Ways and Means and ask for more. And finally, just briefly on remedies, because you're going to hear a little bit more from my colleagues. So in addition to back pay, equitable relief and attorney fees and costs are already authorized for these causes of action. House Bill 2856 would also authorize the greater up compensatory damages, or $200, and punitive damages, and would also entitle claimants or defendants to require jury trials for the following claims. So these are all expanded remedies beyond what's existing law today. Discrimination based on a wage claim, violations of sick leave law, violations of family leave law, discriminations based on leave to attend a criminal proceeding, discrimination based on leave related to certain domestic violence, harassment, sexual assault, and incidents. And what I think is added back in based on the dash one that I just reviewed quickly is discrimination based on the inquiry or disclosure of wage information under 659A.355. Those are pretty significant overall remedies expansions. We would ask that you look at them each individually because it does impose punitive damages on employers. Probably the most concerning is paid sick leave. As you know, we are less than 2 months into the entire penalty provision under that law. And then just lastly, a comment that was made by one of the previous speakers regarding education to employees through BOLI. I think I was here last year testifying to Representative Evans's bill that would require BOLI to put online training materials for all employers so that we could get our farmers and our employers east of the mountains trained up beyond just June, which is how long it took BOLI, unfortunately, to get out there and train. It took me a couple of minutes to get online and Google BOLI. The paid sick leave law page on BOLI has the left side says four employers, and the right says four employees. And we actually use that as an example for the Treasury Department when they're putting together their retirement saves program as a great example for an agency that both reached out to employers and to employees. In addition, there's a frequently asked question site on the BOLI webpage, both for employers and for employees. So an employee can literally Google in, what if my employer is not doing this? And it will lead you to that BOLI frequently asked question page. Again, another example that we use for the Treasury is they're crafting their rules on retirement of a great way an agency is reaching out to both the employer and the employee community.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are the state's largest general agriculture association, representing 7,000 farming and ranching families across the state and about 65,000 members statewide. I think Amanda hit on some really great points in her testimony regarding the initial provisions of the bill. We look forward to seeing how investments in 2016 are implemented going forward, and believe that this is a step where we don't really know that we need this information at this point. If we do, let's make those investments. Let's make those investments in BOLI technical assistance. but at this point, we haven't really seen the 2016 investments implemented on the ground. I think at this point, for the bill in front of us, OFB is most concerned, the Farm Bureau is most concerned about penalty for the number of unlawful employment practices listed by Amanda, particularly about concerned about the punitive damages against employers with regard to paid sick leave. I think you all are aware we came before this committee in 2016 and before the Senate in 2016 asking for clarity to the paid sick leave law. We've brought bills forward over the past couple of years. It's not that our employers, particularly my employers, don't want to be good actors, and they're looking to implement this bill in a way that is in compliance with the intent of the legislature and with the BOLI rules, but they are looking at 16 pages of rules and two rulemakings and are incredibly overwhelmed. And for us, this is very much a stick approach to getting to compliance. If you're looking for employer compliance, especially for small and family-run businesses, and I think often, at least for my members, they don't have a separate HR department, so they're looking at the rules online, they're trying to figure out how they're going to implement it on the ground. This is incredibly daunting. And I firmly believe that the penalties that you see listed in this bill aren't going to drive folks to compliance, but they're going to drive them to leave the industry. They're not interested in gotcha situations, and I can imagine that my folks and listening to them talk about these and similar bills where penalties are levied as opposed to incentives for compliance, that they would feel like they were stuck in that sort of situation that they couldn't get out of. So to that end, if we are looking to make future investments in compliance, especially as it relates to paid sick leave or wage disclosure, I think there's a lot of on-the-ground effort needed, especially with small employers. I can go into a room, and I think so Farm Bureau has three bills that we're running this session to actually add some clarity back in to the paid sick leave law so that our folks can implement it better. But when you go on the ground, and we run three-hour workshops, and BOLI has done some fantastic technical assistance workshops as well for our members, at the end of it, after they hear about all the different provisions, we will ask them now who here feels like they're in 100% compliance. And my folks want to be there. They just didn't realize that there was this provision that put them back out of compliance. So the punitive relief or the punitive damages portion is very daunting for our members. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. First, I want to acknowledge that the stories that we've heard and probably will continue to hear are egregious, they're horrible, and I certainly hope that no member of the Association of Nurseries has ever done anything even close to the stuff that we've heard about today. We are firmly opposed to wage theft and want to do everything that we can to make sure that it and any other action against an employee that is illegal remains illegal, and that those employers are firmly and swiftly disciplined. However, as you heard from my colleagues today, we have great concerns about spreading the enforcement dollar even thinner than it already is. In both Section 1 and 2, which deals with the grant program, and Section 3 that deals with the punitive damages, this bill really seems to delegate BOLI's authorities to either a private entity or a civil court. We actually think BOLI probably needs more resources, and if we're going to spend money on doing employee or employer outreach, we should be doing that within BOLI so that we have a sort of full-service suite of programs that help employees make sure that their rights are known and followed, and make sure that and helps employers make sure that they're in compliance, because the folks who are generally represented by the groups up here are really interested in being in compliance with the numerous changes in the last couple of years in employment law. There's a lot of folks who are still working and struggling to be in compliance, but that doesn't mean that they're trying to do something wrong. They're just trying to be in compliance. I would argue, and you've heard us say this many times before, the folks who commit wage theft aren't interested in being in compliance, and making something even more illegal isn't going to help. That's a really unfortunate situation, but it is what it is. So I just want to echo what both Amanda and Jenny have said. And lastly, I want to acknowledge the absence of Betsy Earls. She couldn't be here today, and it takes three of us to replace her. So thank you.
Okay.
I hope she's listening.
I'll be sure to relay that to her. I really appreciate your testimony today. Thanks.
Thank you.
Up next, I'm going to have Kate Sussman, Jimmy Hahn, and Rebecca Camberling. Oh, Art Towers.
Thanks.
I saw you were together with Rebecca Camberling. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Kate Sussman, and I'm an attorney in Portland. For the last 2.5 years, I've done pro bono work at the VOS Workers' Rights Education Project. And real briefly, VOS is a place where you can safely hire a day laborer, and they also provide skills classes, leadership training, and a wage theft clinic. I worked in the wage theft clinic for the last 2.5 years, working on issues that we've been talking about today. We're open 4 hours a week, all volunteer, and it's open to any worker who has questions, day laborers or otherwise. I won't go through how the clinic works, but there's more information in my written testimony about that. At VOS, I saw cases where someone was owed as little as $16 and as much as $3,600. Sometimes it's very difficult to know how much you're owed, often because of a lack of pay stubs or proper documentation from your employer. Sometimes a client comes in simply with a question about the law or a feeling they've been mistreated. I'll briefly tell you about one client to sort of explain the need for some help navigating our administrative and legal system to deal with workplace rights. I'll call this client Rosa. She worked at a large grocery store in Gresham, well in excess of 40 hours a week, not getting overtime. For the first few months, she was not getting minimum wage. She was denied breaks during her shifts, which were about 11 or 12 hours. When she asked about this, she was told to wear a diaper to work, which is something I've actually heard more than one time. It's obviously very upsetting. Also, her employer kept her pay stubs when she received her paycheck. They asked for them back. So she found her way to us. A friend told her about VOS. The conditions had been going on for over a year. The other volunteer attorney and I researched the grocery store and found out there was an active case with the Department of Labor regarding similar other violations. She was too late to join the suit that was already going through the Department of Labor, so we talked about other options. She decided to go through BOLI. I attached the BOLI claim form to my testimony. I don't know if you see it, but even for a lawyer, there's a lot to read. It's long. There are questions that are hard for a worker, such as list the dates for which you weren't paid properly. In Rosa's case, she wasn't really sure. She knew her schedule generally. It's a, you know, here at this date to that date form. So when I fill it in, I write all the things for them. And it's been sent back to me quite a few times because it's very hard to match up with what Bully's expecting on that and other parts of the claim. It took us about 3 hours to fill out the calendar section because it was over a year where she'd been mispaid. After three separate visits with Rosa, we submitted the paperwork to Bowley, and Bowley took over from there. Her other option would have been small claims court, and there are some issues needing help there too. Most of the VOS clients are day laborers or very low-wage workers, and to file in small claims costs between $53 and $95. This can be waived with a form. So I've also attached that form. Just anecdotally, when I was looking for this form, it took me some time, I think about 8 clicks, to get to the right page. And when I got to that page, there were 5 choices, and the choices, they're complicated, even for an attorney. It's 5 pages long. You have to fill out information like, how much do you spend on the bus per month? Are you currently seeking temporary child support? And all this information, which is necessary, but at a certain point, I think I've seen many workers say, I'm not sure if this is worth my $200. You know, this is a lot of information to give. This is a lot of time. This is a headache. So all this is to say there's really a need for help navigating the systems we have and I think this bill would do a lot towards that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we are starting to run short of time, so I'm going to try to keep moving on the testimony. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jimmy Hahn. I'm a resident of Seattle, Washington, and I'm the political director for the Northwest Carpenters Union. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2856. On virtually a daily basis, our organization interacts with construction workers, and it is abundantly clear that the vast majority of them are unaware of their workplace rights. This is many times more common on non-union job sites. Simple things like how overtime works and what is the state prevailing wage for carpentry work is widely unknown. We decided to take action last summer by hosting monthly meetings for Portland area non-union wood framers. Turnout started at about a few dozen workers, and now we're getting about 100 to show up. We've created a safe environment for these carpenters to come and ask us questions about the same things House Bill 2856 is setting out to do. In fact, just last month, a group of 10 wood framers that have been cheated out of overtime and duly owed wages, we were helping them and we got them connected with Bowley, so now they have the right resources. They did not understand or have any knowledge of how badly they were being ripped off, nor what their rights were and how to remedy the situation. I'm pleased to report that we have put them all in touch, and they are now filing the wage claims. But this would never have happened if we hadn't taken matters into our own hands. There are dozens and dozens of other examples of this that we've encountered over the years. The famous S&S drywall case out of Hillsboro, Oregon, started by us becoming aware of workers not being paid properly, and it ended up with a federal tax evasion conviction. I applaud the efforts of Family Forward Oregon and this committee to empower working people with the knowledge they deserve. Outreach and awareness is integral and complements the newer bully tools that have been provided to combat wage theft. With your help, we can create a fair balance between employees and employers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I know that maybe you can have Rebecca come up and one of you can step down for a moment.
So I'll be fast.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and this is probably the most important testimony I'll provide before this committee of this session. I want to make 3 points about the short version of this testimony. Is I want to make 3 points about this bill. First of all, what we're asking for employees in this bill is the same sort of protection and enforcement that employers enjoy too. We hear testimony saying the vast majority of employers are solid citizens, want to do the right thing. I believe that. But I also believe that when it comes to issues like non-compete clauses, confidentiality and trade secrets, and fraud, that the vast majority of employees are solid citizens too that don't want to violate those laws. Yet each one of those laws allows the employer to file suit against the employee and have the right to a jury trial to get those laws enforced so that when an employee defrauds a company, the employer can take them to court. When an employee discloses a trade secret, the employer can sue them and take them to court. And so we feel like that playing field should be leveled in this bill. Mm. Second point that I want to make is that many of you have voted to protect workers over the years on various things because you believe it's the right thing to do. But it makes no sense for you to, that's a strong statement, it makes a little bit less sense to vote for worker protections if the workers you're fighting for can never enjoy the fruits of your labor. You don't get credit from the opponents of the bills for passing a version with weaker enforcement. So it makes more sense to pass a version that has strong enforcement provisions and gives workers the protections they deserve and that you want them to have. And then finally, I want to go back to a bill from 2015 that this committee hashed out and worked on for quite some time. At the end of the session, earned bipartisan support 55-4. That bill was House Bill 3816. It's a bill having to do with injured workers and workers' compensation. In that bill, one of the provisions said that it required insurance companies to pay workers' legal bills when the insurance company was interviewing the workers, trying to find fraud in their injury claims. Okay, what had been going on is that those interviews have been lasting for multiple hours many times, and now that the insurance companies are paying the workers' legal bills, in many of those instances, the interviews are less than 30 minutes. Why? Because there's really not fraud in a lot of the injury claims, and the ones that are not suspicious, they just get right through it and knock it right out. And so, you know, that hasn't resulted in a ton of work for attorneys. What it's done is made life easier for workers with legitimate claims. And I think that that's what this bill would do as well. So I'll stop there. Ms. Camberling, also with OLA, has some examples. And
thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Rebecca Camberling, and I'm here testifying today on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I have worked for over 10 years on both sides of the bar. I've worked for the defense, and I've worked for the plaintiffs. I still represent small businesses, and I represent individuals. So I understand that these enforcement provisions are incredibly important to level the playing field. When you look at the disparate size between some of the employers out there and some of the employees, and what the employers are able to do and what the employees are not able to do, you realize that having a jury trial available is one of the few ways that an individual can be heard and can stand up to the employer. And I want to draw your attention to the case at last week out of Multnomah County, Victor Pierce versus Daimler Trucks North America. Now, as you may know, Daimler Trucks North America is a phenomenally huge employer, multinational, based out of Germany, and runs a few different plants in Portland, Oregon. And it was a claim for a hostile work environment by African-American employees. There were about 12 plaintiffs at the beginning of it, and these employees were subject to things like nooses in the workplace, physical threats about being dragged by nooses behind a pickup truck in the parking lot, comments, graffiti in the bathroom, including swastikas, and that old hangman game with the dashes underneath with a man hanging and the N-word, and spaces for the rest of the N-word. And had a jury trial not been available to these employees, they may never have had their grievances aired, and Daimler would never have actually settled with many of the plaintiffs. And a jury ended up awarding $750,000 in non-economic damages because they only heard a portion of what actually went on, but it was so egregious to them that they agreed that this should not happen. And that was what they agreed was fair. And allowing jurors to have a say really makes the employer stand up and take notice, especially the really big employers who can kind of put them under the rug. And I want to say to the punitive damages worry that we heard expressed just a few minutes ago, punitive damages are incredibly rare. And as you may know, in this state, only 70% of the punitive damages actually goes back to the state. Only 30% goes to the employee whom it is awarded against, and that is taxable. So it's very rare, first of all, for any plaintiffs to bring punitive damages, but second of all, for it ever to be awarded. I can go on about the multitude of cases I have in front of me that where a jury trial is the difference between an employer paying attention and an employer ignoring the employee, but for the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up here. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Representative Barreto, quick question.
Yeah, just a quick question. You mentioned the employer takes the employee to court more often than the employee takes the employer to court?
Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto, no, I didn't mean to imply that or say that outright in my testimony. What I was trying to say is that there are certain statutes for which the employer has the right to take the employee to court. So fraud, non-compete clauses, things like that. And my point was that the employee should have that same right to take the employer to court and have a jury hear the facts of the case.
Okay. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if maybe there is an article, newspaper article or something that summarizes
yes.
the Daimler cases.
Yes.
I'd love to have it emailed to me.
Okay.
Thank you.
I can do that.
So I think I got time for the one last question. I guess when I'm looking at this bill and looking at all the, you know, adjustments to the penalties, you know, we always hear about that is wage theft. How does this equate to just theft? I mean, is it a similar type of penalty? I mean, if wage theft is theft, is You know, I mean, what's the penalty for theft versus wage theft? Are they the same, or?
Well, I have never actually practiced criminal law, so I can't really speak to the theft portion of it. But I know with wage theft, you have workers who don't understand or don't have access to their rights as far as the wage theft is concerned. And so when employers take advantage of that ignorance or take advantage of a lack of education or a lack of language abilities, it actually does more harm than, say, some, you know, two people who are on an equal playing field in any other scenario. It's actually goes above and beyond, I think, just regular theft, breaking into someone's home or whatever the statutory theft is. But you have the additional burden of the taking advantage of somebody who doesn't understand, and we need to fix that. And educating these employees is one of the ways in which we can do that.
So you don't see the remedy being adequate under our current process through BOLI on trying to address all of these cases?
Well, forgive me if I'm misunderstanding, but we're here to talk today about education as a large part of it, and the remedy isn't enough if the employers don't even, or the employees don't even know to ask for those remedies or how to reach out to get a hold of those remedies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Thank you very much for your testimony. I know several other people have signed up, but we are out of time. We will keep this public hearing as well open until 5 o'clock tomorrow. If you want to send in additional testimony by email, you may do that to the committee analyst. If you give them your email address real quick. Your work one, not your personal.
We'd like you to use the email address that is on the agenda, please.
There you have it. So with that, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2856. Any other business of the committee? No. With that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.